Wrong if I didn't express appreciation for how welcome you've made me feel. I told Skip this morning, he said, what's the plan for that? I said, I don't know. They just tell me what car to get in and strangers to go somewhere with. But boy, what a joy it's been to be in different homes and to enjoy and get to know people's stories and the struggles and successes that they've had in this kind of troubled and fallen world we live in. And I really appreciate the attention. I think you all have mastered the art of looking like you're paying attention. You know, where you just kind of, you follow me around and, you know, kind of can figure out when he said something was supposed to be funny or something like that. But thank you for that. That's been very encouraging. And you remember that when we were going over the topics, the Sunday morning was going to be the secret of successful leadership. And, of course, if it doesn't come up, I blanked it instead of. And there's nothing in the workbook about that, because I didn't want to spoil the secret. I wanted everybody to come this morning in anticipation of getting the inside information of what the secret of successful leadership is. And so that's what we'll do this morning. I'll be glad to give you my sermon notes if you want to review later. But anyway, but I think if you begin by asking the question, what is leadership? In the job I had and retired from, for several years, it was at a university, and I taught in a professional education program as a side element of my job, and I taught courses on leadership. And of course, that's the best way to get the class involved at the beginning, is say, what is leadership? And you get all kind of answers from around, usually reflecting the workplace or the kind of career background people have, their military or politicians or business or whatever. And so there's a lot of definitions of leadership. There are complicated ones, you know. In general, the kind of concept of leadership that all the formal celebrity quotes usually, orbit around is this, that you're appealing to something that's uniquely human in people to motivate them to want to do what they ought to do, even if they don't want to. But that's, that's a parenthesis, right? And so, one quote from a former Navy admiral, a woman, in fact, was you don't manage men into battle, you lead men into battle. Going into battle is not a natural, desirable thing necessarily, but if you can motivate a person to do a very hard thing that they wouldn't do otherwise, that's leadership. Getting someone to do, influencing someone. At the smallest level, the simplest definition of leadership is a person who influences, right? I mean, that is, I'm kind of doing something slightly different than I was before. There's a kind of leadership in that. But, as a preacher, when you're getting a sermon ready, what do? Well, I don't know how you do it, but, pull out the concordance and start looking up the word to see if there are Bible references to it, right? Not just worldly definitions. So, and there are. There's, hundreds of times the word leader, leading is used in the Old Testament, but it generally just refers to a position of authority, the leaders of the people. It's not going to be very informative about what leadership is and certainly the secrets of it and so on. And you go to the New Testament and an odd thing happens. It's used, the Greek equivalent for leaders only used a very few times, 4 or 5 maybe, and they're almost all bad. Why? Because the Jewish leaders, what are they doing in the story of the New Testament? Well, they're trying to kill Jesus, right? And Jesus even uses the word this way. He says, you are blind leaders of the blind. Not a favorable kind of picture. Now, it's influence for sure, but it's not the kind of thing that we want to emulate, of course. So we have to ask the question, what is leadership? And you know where this always ends up, is you go and you look at the perfect, and we've done that this weekend, right? Who is the perfect father? Right? Who is the perfect husband that we find in the New Testament? And those ideal pictures of God and His Son form the basis for knowing what a leader is. You agree with me on that? We've seen that. We looked at Ephesians 5 last night. We looked at all the descriptions of God yesterday morning and said, we can't be like God, but we can try. We can understand the direction we need to go in our self-development. That was kind of what we were saying. So let's look at the leader. Who is our leader right now? Who is our king? Who is our older brother leading us to victory? It's Jesus, of course. And so where is he described for that? And I would actually go to, I think, Psalm 110, which, as I understand it, is a psalm quoted more than any other psalm in different pieces of it. It's a fairly short psalm. It's a psalm of kingship, of leadership, of victory. And you'll recognize some of the, even in these first couple of verses, references that are made to this in the New Testament. So no doubt, it's messianic. In fact, Jesus uses it as a kind of a trick question back to the those Jewish leaders who were challenging him in that last week of his life. The Lord, Yahweh, says to my Lord, sit at my right hand. Position, authority, glory, power, respect, until I make your enemies your footstool. Yahweh sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter, rule in the midst of your enemies. And if you read on in that psalm, especially at the very last part, there are only four or five verses. If you look at the last few verses, it talks about executing the heads of nations. Victory. Bodies strewn, dead bodies, part of the victory. Is that the model of Jesus' leadership? Wait a minute. Who is he ruling here in the midst of? His people? Oh no. This is what happens to the enemies. No, that's the wrong model. We're headed down the wrong path. It's not a rule by strength or force. That's not how he rules his people. That's how he treats the enemies. But look at verse 3. Your people, what? Offer themselves willingly or freely on the day of your power in holy garments. Do you know in the kingdom the secret of successful leadership? You can see it right there. Is it your power and rule? Is it your competence? Your persuasiveness? Your charismatic character? Your undefeatable intellect that can answer every argument? Is that what it is? No, it's there. What is it? How does Jesus rule us? Are we zapped with lightning when we disobey? I've wondered about elders. In fact, we thought about a system in Embry Hills now where parking's a problem, you know. We could fine people for parking in a wrong spot and probably bring in a good bit of money. Or maybe you get fined for coming in late, $1 for every minute that late that you are coming in. How do elders enforce their rule? How do they? It's interesting. There's no passages about elders rule over the flock with harsh, you know, here's penalties and threats. But there are a lot of verses that start with this. Obey them that rule over you. Who's that directed to? It's not to the elders. Just as with husbands. How do they rule their wives? Are they commanded to rule their wives? Is that what it says? Or does it say, wives, be in submission to your husband? You see, the kingdom turns this upside down. What is the secret of successful leadership in the kingdom, in a godly family? What is the secret? It's right there. People follow. Because you're the best in the world. The passage in 1 Thessalonians 5, I believe we covered it when we were here before. So long ago, you wouldn't remember. But it says to know them that labor among you and are over you in the Lord and esteem them highly in love. For why? These are elders, I think. Because they're the smartest people in the church. They were duly elected. They never make mistakes. They know more Bible than anybody else. Is that what that verse says? No. Esteem them highly. What? For their work's sake. It really doesn't even have to do with their character. And the followership, if you can make up a word like that, has to do with the character of those who are following. Do you see that? The kingdom is upside down that way. And that's the way God rules over us. We voluntarily submit. In this age, before the time when every knee shall bow and so on. But we're done. There it is. That's the secret of successful leadership. We have a little more time left, so I was thinking we could kind of do another sermon that would have to do with what does it mean to offer ourselves willingly? In fact, I think I have a title slide coming up, and we'll start the new lesson with this one. All right, so two sermons in one, but the first one was fairly short. That's the secret. The word, the phrase, offer themselves willingly is kind of unique in the Old Testament. I think I could find only two other times where that specific construction is used. One is an interesting case in Nehemiah's time where, you know, they're trying to get Jerusalem going again, right? Get, you know, after the captivity, let's try to restore things. And they're, you know, everybody wanted to go back to their home farm or whatever and rebuild the house and get the plot crops going and so on. But we need some people in the city, right, to keep it going and to support the work that's going on there in the city. And so the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, and the rest of the people cast lots to bring out one of 10 men to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9 out of 10 remained in the other towns. And the people blessed all those men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. I don't know for sure, but I think it was like you were unlucky if you were one of the 10 chosen. You had to go do that work, but you would do it. And they offered themselves willingly to go do that. You see that, be volunteering for something maybe unpleasant, but necessary to be done. The other place, which I want to talk about the rest of the time, is in the book of Judges. And it's in the second account, in a way, of Gideon. Barak. I'm sorry, that's the Georgia pronunciation. But Barak is another way to say it, but the southern pronunciation is Barak. But in the chapter 5, there's a poem ascribed to Deborah and Barak, but Deborah is first person in the thing. So I think of the Song of Deborah. She begins by saying, "When leaders lead," that's one translation, "when leaders lead in Israel." And doesn't that imply that maybe they hadn't been leading up to that point? And something wonderful happened with the story of Barak, which I hope you know that story because I won't spend a lot of time on the details. Something wonderful happened. In fact, the language itself has some implication that something new has and freshly born has happened. And it kind of corresponds to the end of that song where she talks about the sun coming out. This is a new day dawning in Israel. Something's happened here that has not been happening before. What was it? Leaders lead, and what else? The people offer themselves willingly. Same phrase. And really, you can see in that phrase a little bit of a sense of sacrifice, right? A burnt offering. You know that word? The people are the sacrifice. They're willing to risk or maybe even to die. So there is certainly this sense of sacrifice implied in that. And you're going to see why in the story. Of Deborah and Barak and how that evolves. So I want to look at that this morning in our new lesson, our second lesson on what does it mean to offer ourselves willingly. Let's review the story a little bit, and I hope you know it. I love the book of Judges. There's such excitement. I like teaching it because there's great stories, and the more you dig, the more little details and hints and connections to past and future history in Israel. Even though it's a kind of a dark book overall, still, I think the stories are exciting and the information is interesting. The incident occurred about 100 years after Joshua. And there's some details there. I'm trying to resist going into all that I know or actually maybe have confused over time. But the city of Hazor is kind of the capital where Jabin was ruling from and oppressing the people. Joshua had conquered that city and burned it, apparently, 100 years before. But now the Canaanites had grown and established it back again. And it was, you know, in between was Ehud, the left-handed Benjamite. We talked about Benjamites the other morning. They're cool guys. They're the special ops. They're the Navy SEALs, right, the Army Rangers. They know what they're doing. Sling a stone, both hands. Ehud was left-handed. That was kind of handy, right, for that homemade dagger and the deal with the Moabite king and so on. Anyway, those guys, Ehud, Shamgar, have come and gone. They're heroes of the past, and they were pretty much lone rangers, I think. It reads that way. And they weren't like marshaling 100,000 men like we're going to see, or 10,000 men as we see here. There was a spiritual apostasy. That's described in chapter 4, verse 1, and 5:8. And you know that's the cycle in Judges. I don't think I have to spend a lot of time with that. But I think that spiritual apostasy made it more difficult for people to step up and say, we should be able to do something with the power of God behind us for these enemies. But after 20 years, it probably seemed very hard. There was a 20-year Canaanite domination. You know, a lot of the judges dealt with enemies from somewhere else, right? Maybe the Moabites would come in, or the, Gideon? Midianites come in. And an external enemy, but the Canaanites. They're like, we should have driven them out. And there they are, they're oppressing us. And what a problem there. Sisera was the captain of Jabin's army. And they had 900 chariots. 900 chariots of iron. Interesting archaeology has kind of showed us that in that area of the world, there was a transition going on from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. I don't know exactly what that means. I think it meant they could heat up metal more and get a harder result, iron and not bronze, right, which would be softer. And so, but I'll just tell you, you probably know this, the Israelites were way behind on technology. They weren't making that transition, but the Canaanites were, and the Philistines were. You may remember that the Israelites, down in the time of Samuel, had to take their farm implements, where? Down to Philistia to get them sharpened, because they had no blacksmith, anybody could work in iron in the country. Well, these were 900 chariots of iron. That's a combined arms army or something, right? It's the mobile division, right? Chariots of iron. I don't know. Think about how that would operate. There probably is a driver, and I know there's a horse, right? And there may be a soldier in the back with a bow or a spear or rocks or something who's just, you know, taking people out. And if they're not taken out by him, you just roll over them. It's a chariot of iron after all. Israel had nothing like that. They didn't even have horses, really, till the time of Solomon. They probably weren't supposed to, as a matter of fact. They were short of weapons. In fact, think about the weapons you hear about in Judges. Ox goad, jawbone of a donkey. One of the guys led 300 men into battle with pitchers and torches and trumpets. That was their weapons. That's a weird. And it says in the song that there wasn't a spear or sword seen in Israel. So compare that, more or less disarmed, to 900 chariots. And it's interesting in the story how many times those 900 chariots are mentioned. They almost forms a theme over and over. And the 900 chariots came out, you know. And at the end, even at the end, when there's this kind of imaginary picture of Sisera's mom waiting at home. Where is he? Where is he? I'm waiting to hear the sound of his chariot driving in the driveway, you know. That's a theme throughout, is this superior weapon that the Israelites had to go against. Here's some geography about that. So Hazor, you see up at the top there, is in way in the northern part, and the tribe of, now in the south we say Naphtali, but Naphtali, however you want to say it. But anyway, that's the tribe of Barak, actually, up there. Now Deborah's down here. I think I can animate this. There's Hazor. That's where the kingdom kind of ruler guy is, Jabin. And down here in the valley, and you probably know that's the Carmel Range jutting out into the Mediterranean there, where Haifa is today. And then there's the Kishon River. That's important in the story. You probably remember. And then there's this big flat plain out there, Jezreel Valley. And guess where chariots operate best? In the flat plains. That's kind of the geography of that. Now, Deborah is down here. So that's where Barak is. Deborah's down here in the south. Well, in Ephraim, kind of on the border of what became the northern and southern kingdoms. And she sits there and men come up to her for judgment. She is a prophetess, also a wife of Lapidoth or somebody, and also a mother. She says, I'm a mother in the poem itself. So that's Deborah. Now, there's a place that's kind of important, and that is Mount Tabor. And I've used the triangle to designate it, but it actually is kind of a triangle or a cone. You know, it sits out in the middle of kind of some fairly flat area, especially as it faces the Valley of Jezreel. And it's just there. I'll show you a picture in a minute of what it looks like today. But it's just kind of I don't know if it had trees on it in those days or not, but it's kind of exposed, but it's a hill for sure. You'd have to climb to get, you know, up onto that mountain. And so there's a bit of the geography. You kind of got that in mind. And there is, this place is called Harosheth Hagoyim, down this circle, and we don't know where that is. But the thought is that there's some places along that mountain range, the Carmel mountain range, where maybe a steep valley goes up kind of perpendicular to the line of the mountains, maybe a mile wide or so. Perfect bat cave for the chariots, right? And that's probably in that area where the chariots were waiting, ready, listening for Jabin's command, and Sisera comes roaring out with his 900 chariots. And that was the way they dominated the land. And I'll add as a side point, just because I think it's interesting, the flat land was always a challenge for the Israelites. You can go back in the very first chapter of Judges, and it says they didn't take they got the mountains, they could handle that, but they couldn't take the flat areas. And I've kind of suspected that, you know, it never quite says in Ephraim, even in this chapter. Yeah, Deborah was in Ephraim. That's where she was doing her prophesying. It never says that. You know what it says? What does it always say? It doesn't just say in Ephraim. It says in the hill country of Ephraim. Why is that? That's all they could take. And back during the conquest, it was only the hills that they could handle. And so it's always the... And I'm wondering if the... whoever Samuel, whoever wrote Judges, you know, was poking in the hill country of Ephraim. You know, that ordinary tribes always causing trouble, but they only could take the hill. In fact, they complained they didn't get enough land. Well, I'm off track. But anyway, and Joshua, who, by the way, I think himself was an Ephraimite, said, you know what? If you're such a great tribe and need so much land, why don't you go take all your land, including the flat areas? That was kind of his argument back to them. Anyway, that's where they were. But that's down here. I shouldn't even have talked about that. It's fascinating to me. We learn from the poem, which recounts the battle in some additional details, the song, what you're going to call it in chapter 5, that commerce and social life was suppressed. You really couldn't even hardly travel from one village to another. You had to go in secret because of these oppression of the Canaanites. And there was little national unity. And what you see is there were no leaders in Israel. And you kind of see that the way that poem begins. When leaders do finally lead, then and the people offer themselves willingly, that leads to wonderful things. And that's what I want to explore this morning. Now, I know that those who would be eager to defend the women's roles as leaders love to talk about Deborah. I want to say that I'm becoming convinced that I've seen some pretty strong evidence that there is a kind of a comedy going on in chapters 4 and 5 of Judges. And it's a comedy in that world, at that time, among the Canaanites and Canaanite literature. The comedy was when men didn't do what they were supposed to and women had to do it for them. I think it's kind of the way that the whole chapters are written. And if you think of it in those terms, we think of it today as, well, Deborah was a prophetess, as if somehow she should be preaching up here today if she was here. She wasn't doing that. She sat under a tree. She wasn't out like the judges later would do, ride on donkeys and go their circuit. That's not Deborah. In fact, she didn't, it seemed to me, she didn't initiate anything. People came to her, and that's a little humor in that. Where are the men in this situation? They should know the law. They should have some kind of wisdom. They're going down to Ephraim and talk to Deborah. I don't know what the answer is, but maybe she can tell me. And you can see in a culture where that was not the women's and men's roles, that would be almost humorous to think about, right? And you remember yesterday, the men, we talked about how these heroes that we like in these movies, it always ends with what? Hand-to-hand combat, right? The bad guy, the baddest guy of all against the goodest guy of all. And even if they had lasers and blasters and everything through the whole movie, they end up having a hand-to-hand fight at the end. Y'all know what I'm talking about, right? Who has the hand-to-hand fight at the end of this story? Who uses what is at hand is actually what the text says. Who does that? Jael, a woman, the wife of Heber, the Kenite. I would think if you were reading that in that time, and you can look at some of the other literature where if you wanted to insult another man's army, what would you call them? You've got an army of women, right? And in that culture, that's kind of the way it would read. In fact, one funny thing is that when Sisera is, of course, he's running, right? He's at the end. He runs and he comes to this tent and he goes and he says, you know, could you let me in here? And you know what he says to her? He says, if someone asks, is there a man in this tent? What's she supposed to tell him? No, there's not a man in there. Right? That's the way that... If you read it in kind of that way and look at the various details and see it from the point of view of a culture in which, you know, the men fought the wars and the battles and they did the hard things and they were supposed to be the leaders. And you read both of those chapters, you start seeing somebody's kind of almost making fun of things here. Right? The Israelites don't have leaders. In some ways... It's a counter-argument to the idea that, well, Deborah was a preacher, you know, so there. I think it's the other way. Maybe the poem is actually saying the problem here is when men don't do what they're supposed to do. And they have to be kicked in the pants to get up to go do what they're supposed to do. Where was Jabin's capital city, Hazor? It was in the territory of Barak's tribe. Who should have taken responsibility? Deborah, way down there in Ephraim? Or Barak? In his own backyard. Who should have done that? In fact, when she calls Barak, what does she say? I can't remember the exact words, but it's something like, has not God called you? I got to put my glasses on and turn to the chapter to read it, but you'll find it. Yes, verse 6, chapter 4. She sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kedesh in Naphtali and said to him, "Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Tabor?" Now, I don't know if she's just saying, "God told me to tell you this," or if she's just saying, "You need to pick this up. It's a responsibility you need to get going on." And what's interesting, if you think about Barak, I don't know where I am on this, but anyway, if you think about Barak, what kind of a leader do you think he is now? Did he volunteer for this job? Does he seem a little reluctant in this story? Yeah. In fact, if you look at Hebrews, and time will fail to tell of all that's in Hebrews, but the writer does mention the judges in interesting pairs where they're kind of switched in order. Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, they're switched in order. It seems to pair Gideon with Barak. What did they have in common? They both were doubtful men. They needed reassurance, right? They needed that. But what's not said about Barak, which is said about Gideon by the angel, is she finds him. This is another ironic scene. I said she. The angel, sorry, he finds Gideon where? In a wine press. And calls him what? Mighty man of valor. I'm thinking Gideon's going, what? Now, later, Jephthah, chapter 11, verse 1, he is called a mighty man of valor. First verse about him. Right? None of that said about Barak. He just lived in Naphtali, and Deborah says, "You got a job to do." And you know what he says? You know what he says. Another one of those humorous things, I think. "Will you go with me?" Doesn't he? Is that a good thing to have said, or maybe he gets a little criticism for that? Yeah, okay, sure, I will, of course I will. But as a result of that, you know, a woman is going to get credit for this victory. You see that? What are you thinking about Barak as a qualified leader here against 900 chariots of iron, trained soldiers, right, with this unarmed army of some kind? So what does the battle look like? Let's go through it. Deborah calls a reluctant Barak in 4:6 to his duty. And then Barak, to his credit, begins to call the Israelites, starting with his own tribe and territory, right? And he gets 10,000 men to come. Great piece of work, I think. And they come to Mount Tabor. That's what Mount Tabor looks like today. You see kind of the pattern there, flat land all around and a conical mountain, right? If you were going against 900 chariots, where would you like to be? I'd be on top of that thing, right? Probably behind the biggest rocks I could find, right, where chariots don't operate very well. But that's kind of the scenery. But you can see the flat area down below, at least as it looks today. And as a result, and I think about this, if I had 10,000 men coming, I don't think they came like all at once, like within a couple hours. It probably took them days together. So over time, I'm imagining this string, and it's not that big of a mountain. 10,000 people would be visible on that mountain. So there's no ambush here being planned, right? There's no surprise element, except maybe just a surprise that Sisera probably felt looking up there and said, "What? What are they going to do? What are they going to do? They're unarmed. We're down here." And so Sisera gets news of this, and he gathers his chariots in the plain, of course, down below. And he's drawn there, it says there. And I think, of course, that was God's plan, but that's what Sisera would do anyway. "Okay, you want to fight? Sure, I'm ready." Out of the back cave, down to the mountain, watch those guys. And then, in kind of simple terms, at least in chapter 4, he's just defeated, it says, by God. But you have to read chapter 5 to know kind of more of the details of that. One thing that's interesting about that piece of the story is that, you remember, Deborah went with Barak. That was part of the deal. And it seemed like there's some point they're up on the mountain, and I don't know, y'all that have been in important, you know, football games, maybe a championship game the next day. How do you feel the night before? You know what I mean? I think a little bit of that probably amplified. But I'm up on the mountain in the dark maybe, and I can hear the little jingle jangle of the horses and things down in the valley. I know what they look like. I've seen them. And I'm up there without any weapons, sitting on that mountain. And I'm thinking, what are we going to do here? What's the plan? We all came because we were supposed to, but I don't know. And this Barak guy, and he's got a woman telling him what to do, you know, among other things. But there comes a point in which, and I'm also thinking about Sisera looking up there saying, what are they going to do? And then there comes a point when Deborah says, it says it in the text, she says, now, go now. So she actually kind of initiates. I don't know if she kind of pushed him down the hill and said, go, you know, this is it. Or if she just said, I'm looking at the clouds, I think about now would be good. Right? Maybe she was great at weather prediction because you know what happened. But they start down the hill, and I'm imagining Sisera saying, what are those guys doing? This is going to be a slaughter. This should be fairly easy. Well, of course, you know what happened is there was a storm. And apparently there's references to Sinai and the quaking of Sinai and all that. It scared the horses. And then it got muddy. And then the Kishon River overflowed and flooded everything. And how do chariots do in the mud? That's it. They were stuck. And that explains why Sisera, of all things, if I had a chariot and was trying to run away, I'd stay in the chariot. But he couldn't. He had to get off on foot and run away. That explains that. Who was responsible for that? Well, God gave him the victory. And I'm assuming that after, you know, you capture somebody, there's one sword I got, and you got another one, you know what I mean? And slowly over time, the battle turns, and then the victory is provided. Oh, a source of great celebration when that was done. So Sisera escapes, but is killed by Jael. She's not even an Israelite. It's interesting to see the story of the Kenites. Starting back, actually mentioned in Abraham's time, Jethro's descendants. They live among the Israelites peacefully, and really actually in a pious way, we learn from Jeremiah 35 and the Rechabites. But their history is nicely intertwined with Israel. They live in tents. Which explains the weapon of choice for Jael. Y'all know the weapon she used. And I'll talk some more about that in a little bit. All right, how do we offer ourselves willingly? Now, with that short introduction, I'm so proud. I almost feel like a real preacher. I have 3 points from now to the end. So that's what we'll do the rest of the time, is to look at the story, mostly at the details that Deborah provides in the song, and see how we offer ourselves willingly. And here's why it's relevant. Yesterday morning, the men, we took some self-assessments about how good we are at maybe initiating Bible study, being spiritually minded, at providing for our family, of setting an example of discipline, of being aware of our children's needs and our wives' needs and putting them first. And it may be that some of these guys are going to try to put in place, despite their, you know, Barak-like character, their lack of qualifications, the mistakes they've made, the lack of initiative they've had in the past, whatever it is, it may be that they will put in place some initiatives in some way for the family. And what will be the secret of that leadership? What will be the secret of that leadership? Will somebody follow? You see that? That's what's going to empower them to try to do what their God-given job is. Same thing true with the elders. The elders, maybe it's different here, ours are not perfect, right? I know that. And they'll try their best. They'll put things in place that will try to improve the congregation and help them watch out on behalf of your souls, which is their primary job. Will that be successful or not? What's the secret of successful leadership? Is the people offer. And by the way, think of those men launching themselves down Mount Tabor into the mouth of 900 chariots of iron. Does that kind of remind you of a sacrifice in a way? The idea of offering yourself, oh yeah. It might, in their mind, they might be thinking, well, this is the end for me, but I'm doing it. I'm following. I'm offering myself willingly. So the elders have something to put in place. The set secret of success will be how to offer. Now, I want to talk some more about the details, 3 points, about how it is that we offer ourselves willingly. And I think there's some secrets right here, looking at the details that Deborah provides in her song. The first is to show up. Look at the text now in careful detail in chapter 5. Do I have the details here? Yeah. Reuben, starting in verse 15, near the end. Reuben, you know, was one of those Transjordan tribes. And they may have thought, hey, I'm sorry for my brethren over on the west, but, you know. But no, they were concerned. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. Well, why did you sit among the sheepfolds? You hear the piping of the flocks. Oh, the divisions of Reuben have great searchings of heart. But did they come? No. Oh, they were all for those brave Naphtali, you know, warriors and others that came. But, and they, we thought about it. We're with you in spirit, right? We feel bad about the whole thing, but we're just not able to come. That's not our business, maybe. Not interested in that. Gilead, that's a kind of a region that includes those Transjordan tribes, half-tribe Manasseh and Gad, for example. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan. He just stayed home. Too busy. You know, you have to take care of the farm. You can't just go off and be gone for weeks at a time. What would that do to your crops and other things? That just wouldn't work. Right? A man's got to make a living. We have other things in our lives. We have schoolwork. We have sports. We have hobbies. There's a March Madness going on. I need to take care of that. This is much of an inconvenience and risk, by the way, to go over there and be a part of that army. Gilead and Dan remained on the ships, now up to the north. Asher, by the seashore of the Mediterranean, remained on their ships. I'm sorry, Asher continued at the seashore and stayed by the inlets. You know, if you leave things, you got jobs and you got all kinds of things going on, and we're just too busy to go and follow those leaders who and by the way, I don't trust that Barak guy anyway. And really, how many chariots were there again? I don't think this is a good plan. His character, his planning, I don't think that you can kind of see how that was going on. Show up. At least come. Know what the plan is. Be willing to participate, whatever that is. And look down at verse, I think it's 23, Miraz. We don't know what or where Miraz is, but it says, "Curse Miraz," said the angel of the Lord. "Curse its inhabitants bitterly because they did not come to help the Lord, the help of the Lord against the mighty." Miraz was probably a city. And the best explanation that I've seen is that it was a city near Hazor that had made a truce with Hazor, perhaps. Because there's the language of treason almost in this curse. Could it be that Miraz had kind of made a plan where they were kind of in a, you know, treaty of peace for their own benefit, of course, with Jabin, right, in Hazor. And as a result of that loyalty, they couldn't come because they were kind of in the camp of the enemy already. Does that ever happen with us? Where there is some spiritual activity, maybe it's a Bible study, maybe it's participation in family worship, and because of what's actually really going on in our lives, in a way our betrayal or a double life we're living, we're just not motivated to do it. We feel hypocritical, in fact, doing it. And it would stand in our way. I think that's a good explanation for what Miraz's problem was. They're cursed here for not coming. The others criticized for sure, but it's very possible that Miraz represented an alliance, an unholy alliance that they had made, that because of that they could not or did not come to the battle. Okay, second point, how do we offer ourselves willingly? And that is bring and use what we have. Take a look at verse 14. From Ephraim, and by the way, Ephraim was such a troublesome tribe. It seemed like they liked to fight with the, you know, other Israelites even, you know, but they were always getting, but still, that's kind of maybe who you'd like to have along. From Ephraim were those whose roots were in Amalek. And I think that suggests war experience. The Ephraimites knew about things. Amalek was a perennial enemy. The Amalekites, you probably remember some of the stories about them. And Ephraim had experience, apparently, in military battles and things like that. So Ephraim came, glad to have them. We're glad to have them. We need the people who have that experience. After you, Benjamin, with your peoples. We already talked about the Benjamites, the special ops forces, right? Those skillful warriors, Benjamites, that came. And I understand that. That's important skill to have. But from Maker, verse 14 in the middle there, that's probably part of Manasseh, probably the western part of Manasseh. Rulers came down. And now, the word ruler doesn't really mean like a king or a, you know, a mayor or something. Rulers there means lawgivers in the original. These were kind of, I would say, administrators. Teachers, really, is the idea there. Teachers of the law who were there, good administrators. And from Zebulun, which is up there in the north, close to Naphtali, those who bear... I don't know what your version says. It probably says a lot of different things. Mine says the recruiter's staff, but that's certainly a guess. The literal word means that they carry the writer's quill. That's what it means. Now, what would the writer's quill be used for? Maybe recruiting. That's one idea. I don't know, sending messages. But I'm imagining the night before the battle, they're up on the mountain. They're those, you know, hardened, rugged Benjamites with the scars of battle, you know, and the Ephraimites are there. And, you know, they're ready. And they look over those guys carrying around quill pens and thinking, what are those guys going to do? You know, and I don't know, but they came. And they brought their writing instruments. And I don't know, maybe they carried messages or kept track of the dead or whatever. I don't know. But they came. And so I've now got administrators and I've got people running around with writer's quills going to fight against this chariot. But they came. You see that? And isn't the case that if there's something going on, maybe we're not going to be the very best contributor to whatever the initiative is that the elders or the church has decided to do as a collective group or the family is implementing in some way. But bring what you have. There are skills that can be used. You might not think they're useful, but just your presence for sure would be useful as well. The princes of Issachar were with Deborah. As Issachar, so was Barak, sent into the valley. Under his command is a loose translation. At his feet is actually what it says, or under his feet. So they were submitting themselves into that sacrificial battle under the feet of Barak. And then, of course, Zebulun and Naphtali, we should read that. Zebulun is a people who jeopardized their lives to the point of death. Naphtali also on the heights of battle. You know who else used what they had, brought what they had to the battle? You know, we can't go without mentioning Jael. So the Kenites lived in tents. I mentioned that before. And guess who had responsibility for setting up the tent? Or setting it back up once it blew over, you know what I mean? Or a stake came out of the ground or whatever. And I know they used stakes because I can see that in the story. Well, that's the women's job. They kept that up. And so what was she good at? Among probably many things, but for sure one thing she was real good at and knew where the tools were. Tents and stake pegs, right? And so when it came time and the opportunity arose, she just used what she had. And it's a kind of a violent picture. And the poem even makes it more graphic. It's almost like, you know, took three whacks to get that thing all the way through his head and into the ground. Y'all know the story, I think. But she brought what she had, and she knew when to use it, and she used it. She's called in the song by Deborah, I think, most blessed of women. Only one other woman in the Bible is called that. I don't know if you can remember who that would be. It's Mary, the mother of Jesus. I can't explain that. I'm just telling you what's in the text. But she is praised for what she did. And I think whatever we are, whatever our position is, whatever our skills are, whatever resources we have, bring them. Let's see if they can't be used as we offer ourselves willingly to the leaders that God has given us, despite their qualifications and whatever. All right? Point number two. That was point number two. Bring what you have. As each has given a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Whoever speaks is one who speaks the oracles of God. Whoever serves is one who serves by the strength that God supplies, in order that in everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. 1 Peter 4. Third point. And this is strategic in a way, but be a leader maker. Be a leader maker. It was probably not appropriate for Deborah to lead the troops. And she didn't. She said, Barak, it's time to go. But she made him a leader, didn't she? I have to say in my life, if I've ever done anything useful in influencing other people to do what's right, there was somebody, and I would say most often a woman, behind that, who set me off on the right path, who encouraged me, who said, Marty, you know, you need to work on this particular thing. That happened when I was being considered for an elder. The best advice I got from two particular women, mothers in Israel, mothers in Embry Hills, as Deborah says of herself, they came and said, Marty, this is what you need to work on. I'll tell you one of them because maybe it will help you understand. They said, you know, you look like you're angry all the time. And people are afraid to come talk to you. I hope you don't feel that way, but that was something that was, I mean, it was true. And they sensed it and they were courageous enough to tell me that. Do you see how whoever we are, and especially moms and women who are more sensitive to those kind of things, they can be leader makers. And oh, what a force multiplier that is, right? pushed Barak into what he was supposed to do. How many of these husbands need somebody to tell them, you can do this, you need to do it? Has not God commanded you to do it, as Deborah says? And you have the ability with the strength that God supplies, as we saw in that passage from 1 Peter 4. Let's encourage one another that way. It doesn't have to be women kicking the men in the backside. It can be men doing that. Dads, even sons saying to their dads, you can do better than that. That's a leader maker. That's what we do in offering ourselves willingly. And so that's Deborah's thing. And there are in the New Testament so many examples of leader makers. You know who made Timothy what he was up to the point that Paul took him over as his son in the faith? It was his mother and grandmother who taught him the law and had a faith that he eventually adopted as his own. The faith that was first in them and then was later in him. Paul was selected, and he selected and trained and encouraged Timothy in Philippians 2. It tells what a great character Timothy has, and I think it has to be due in part to the mentoring that Paul provided Timothy. Barnabas brought that crazy Saul who had been persecuting the church to the church in Jerusalem and vouched for him. A little bit of a risk on Barnabas' part, perhaps, but he said, we're going to do this. He's a good man. He's been preaching, and his faith is genuine, and they accepted him, going in and coming out in the church there in Jerusalem, and made that advantage for Saul, who eventually became the Apostle Paul. And Jesus, how much of his ministry, especially near the end, was training the 12, teaching them what they should and they shouldn't do, and praying for them at the end in John chapter 17. If, here's a quote there, if you go with me, then I will go, but if you will not, I will not. And she said, I will surely go with you. That's, I seem to me, a metaphor to say to someone, yes, you have a plan, I don't know how you're going to do it, but I'll go with you. I'll bring what I have, whatever talents I have. I'll encourage you. I'll be courageous. I'll offer myself willingly. And that's really the example that we see in Deborah. She was a leader maker. And I think there's maybe even more power in that than actually being the leader itself. There's a force multiplier. It can be done for more than one person. It can continue on to help those who are around. There's an interesting passage in 1 Corinthians 16 about the household of Stephanas. I don't know who they are. I don't think they're mentioned anywhere else. I urge you, brothers, you know that the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Achaia, and that they've devoted themselves to the service of the saints. Do what? Be subject to such as these, to every fellow worker and laborer. And it could be that it isn't a dad, a husband, an elder, or a leader in some way, a teacher in a Bible class. Maybe it's just somebody who has a real good idea in the church. You know, we could do this. This is an outreach that I'm trying to do. What do you think of that? I'm with you. That's a great idea. And here, whoever Stephanas is, he just said, give him support. Go with him. Do it. Do good things. Now, in the end, Stephanas, he looks like the leader, but really what's the secret of that leadership is there are people willing to go along and support and do that good thing that has been initiated by someone else. Phoebe, a woman. I command you to Phoebe, our sister, who is a servant of the church in Cenchrea, that you may receive her in the Lord in a manner worthy of the saints, to assist her. She's the leader. She's setting some goals of doing some kind of business, in whatever business she has need of you, for she has been a helper of many and myself also. Do you see the pattern there? We're making leaders of others by adopting their plans and supporting them in what they need to do. So those are three things. Show up. Maybe a challenge just to do that for some. Use the skills you have. Bring what you've got. And maybe, looking to the future, be a leader maker among our children, among our husbands, among our wives, among our other Christians that are all around us. I think that's what it means to offer ourselves willingly, which is, now you know, the secret of successful leadership. That's what I wanted to say. We're ready to sing the song at the end. I did look at it. Trying to remember what it was.
I want to change it, Marty.
Please do.
641.
Thank you.
Who will follow Jesus?
I love it. Because really, our willingness to follow imperfect men who are spiritually minded is a reflection, a miniature. I'm going to use the point now. Isn't this a little bit of a miniature of our willingness to be subject to God? That's how He rules us. We offer ourselves willingly. And if we're not willing in this world to offer what we have to our earthly fathers, our earthly leaders, how good will we be really at following our Father, whom kind of we have not seen in a way? It's a small pattern, really, for children to grow up to know how to serve God and for us to be better servants. And our unwillingness to submit to rulers, spiritual rulers in this life, may be a reflection of our unwillingness to follow God. And I think that's a good way to think about it. Who will follow Jesus as a pattern of that? Thank you for choosing it. Let's sing.